So I feel like that it's kind of led me into hobbies and things that I think I would do well in, and it changed my behavior. So I feel like since I think that I'm good at this aesthetics or visual appeal, that I can go into photography or, you know, buy a film camera kind of thing. And this is just something that is more of a abstract schema, but that's a less common example for me.
Yeah, and it's still positive too, I think.
Yeah.
Because, like, people are more motivated to work on things that they more deeply identify with.
Mm-hmm.
And are at least what they think about themselves, they try to work harder and put more effort into that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's like if you think you're strong in something, you're like, oh, I should keep putting work into this. And then you actually do become better at mm-hmm. it, which is the whole point.
Yeah. Do you have any more?
I don't have any more.
Okay. I have one that I will share for whatever reason. But anyway, I used to be feeling a lot like an outsider in a lot of situations, like within a group of people or, like, you know, within a friend group even. And I was always like, why am I always the one who's like the least close with everyone? But then I kind of realized that, like, I was often just like invited to an event or like something by one of my friends, and I knew that person and I knew like some other people and they were also my friends, but I'm still like an extended invite, and then I never really invited any of my friends to events with me. Like, I was always the one who got invited. And then I was like, maybe that is part of the reason that I'm just being really passive and then creating this negative self schema that, oh, I'm an outsider, when I'm not even putting any effort into like introducing some of my friends to a different group. Or yeah, like, I kind of just thought, oh, I need to be putting an effort within the group to get close to all of these other people, but they have their own dynamics too.
Right.
And there's, you know, other things going on. So when I started to like integrate people in my life more, that self schema has kind of started to disappear, because it's not a sense of like, this is who I am as a person integrally. Like, it's more also something that you're doing or not doing. And then by changing what you do, it can change how you see yourself too.
Yeah, it's a good example.
So, thanks.
Very good.
Thank you. It took a lot.
Hearing that, I feel like I should add on to my self schema as well. I'm going to go back to that imposter syndrome and that, I guess, the co-op job. Because I do have ADHD, so I feel like because I felt different from all, I felt different from all the other students hired before, is because none of them had ADHD, and they were all, you know, they all seem like the same personality and the same kind of type A, you know, very serious kind of person. And I feel like I showed up being like, oh, I'm kind of, you know, gonna do things my own way, and
kinda
crazy, you know. You know, I do have meds and everything, but I had a lot of times where I really doubted myself of what I could do, and compared myself to the other students, being like, oh, you know, I suck at this, or, you know, why can't I just get organized, or like, why do I make these careless mistakes in the job kind of thing. And, you know, I feel like that really held me back, and I kept thinking about those things, and it did go into this big cycle of, like, you know, this is all this fault, even though we can all work on this, and, you know, everyone is going through their own struggles. Like, the other club student, she had anxiety, and she had to deal with that in her own way. So it's kind of taking a step back and looking at how other people deal with things.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of self schemas are kind of like, you're internalizing a lot of behavior that you have and like making it such a personal thing, when it's in reality, like, there are behaviors that you can change, and there are behaviors mm-hmm. you can just also accept, instead of having to put a certain label on it or not. Be like, oh, this is like a bad behavior of mine, or like, this is super negative. Like, you know, for example, yeah, like what you said is like having ADHD, but that, you know,
is a positive too.
Yeah, it's a positive. It can be a positive, and it can be, you know, contextual too. Like, it doesn't always have to be, you know, a detriment. Anyways, so those are examples I kind of was also curious when I was looking into this more, is like, where do these self schemas come from? Like, where do our beliefs about ourselves come from if they're not even reflective of reality? Like, if they were all reflective of reality, it would kind of make sense. Like, okay, we're all just individually really good at perceiving what kind of person we are. That makes sense. But no, that's not actually true. So there are a lot of nurture aspects, but there also are some nature. So we'll go through the nurturing ones first. A lot of like early childhood experiences, so caregivers modeling a certain way of thinking about themselves. So even I think if you had a parent who was really critical of themselves, and even more specifically like critical of how they looked physically, as a child you kind of internalize that inner monologue or inner narrative, and then you start criticizing yourself physically, and like that can, you know, it's kind of hard when it's rooted like that to stop doing that when you consistently see it modeled.
Yeah, I think I've heard of that example a couple times when the parent, or you, especially the mom, thinks she's overweight or she weighs too much, and then the child compares themselves to the mom, being like, oh, well, I'm bigger than you and you think you're fat, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then the child grows up with that same self-schema, thinking that they're always overweight.
Yeah. And also just other experiences like bullying, any kind of adversity, or being like discouraged or encouraged as a child.
Yeah. I guess like the bullying thing especially. I feel like
the bullying thing hits.
Yeah. Especially like if you're a kid and kids are like, wow, you're ugly and you're no one likes you and kind of thing. You hear that and you grow up with that. So yeah, I think that would be the biggest one.
And you believe it too, because like as a kid, you don't really have like a huge sense of self, or a lot of kids don't. As a kid, I don't think I really could be like, oh, no, I'm not. Like, I'm actually really smart.
Yeah.
But if another kid tells me something about myself, I'm like, oh, okay, so I am. Like,
yeah.
That's true. And then you really internalize that for a long time. Also, once this happens, to like perpetuate it, there's also confirmation bias. So interpreting any kind of new evidence as confirmation of the beliefs that you already have. And I feel like you can confirm almost any belief that you have with information that you're getting from the world. You know what I mean? Like, oh, what my example was like, oh, I'm always an outsider. And then I'd see examples where I felt like that. And of course, I'm already more primed to feel like that because I believe that. And then it just kind of snowballs. Or I'm not sure why I have this as an example. But I guess one of them is like, oh, I hate celebrating my birthday because it's been confirmed like once or twice that it's it's not fun. I feel sad on my birthday. I don't want to invite people. People don't show up. And that's happened like twice. And then I've kind of just given up on the whole birthday idea. So that kind of is like an example of confirmation bias taking over and being like, okay, well, I've already tried twice in all my 22 years of living, and I'm going to take that as a permanent state of being. So this year I'm going to try to celebrate my birthday. If it goes badly again, I don't know if I can recover.
This is a hard one, the confirmation bias. I think this one really took a hold of me. Does take a hold on me all the time. Because it's so hard. Like, I mean, if it confirms what you think you are thinking, then how can you get out of it?
Yeah, how can you fight it back?
I get therapy, but
therapy. And also, what if it is just being confirmed a lot because it's true?
Yeah, it could just be you are. But I mean, you could not be at the same time. I think the first step is just understanding that there is confirmation bias.
Yeah.
Because I even forget that confirmation bias exists too, even right now.
Yeah, so even as we're talking about
even as we're talking, so.
Yeah. There's also, this blew my mind in like first year psychology. I don't know if you guys know about it, probably, but the self-fulfilling prophecy, that happens when someone believes that you have a certain personality trait or stereotype about you, and like they treat you based on this, whatever belief that they have about you, and then that makes you respond in a way that's more aligned with what they believe, and then that fuels the original belief, and then they keep treating you like that, and then you keep acting like that, even though that might not even necessarily be who you are. So there's an example it's a pretty famous study, and it's been replicated a lot, but it's called the Pygmalion effect, where teachers' expectations of students significantly influence their academic performance. So teachers are basically told, like, oh, this student is, you know, a bloomer, or like they had a certain name for these students who were going to be high achievers. And actually, these students did end up doing a lot better because the teacher paid more attention to them, like, believed that they were going to be a better student, so put more resources into them. Like, not super obviously as well. Like, I think it was more subtle, but then those students did end up doing a lot better, like, significantly better because of this label that was put onto them. So that's kind of interesting, yeah.
That kind of ties into expectations, but I've seen many studies where it relates to the gender gap. I mean, for math scores, for example, because a lot of teachers believe, and there's research out there that they just put down female students because they think that women are worse at math than boys. So this, I guess, with this bias in mind as well, with the effect that it does influence the performance and keep continuing the cycle, or at least be a contributor to the cycle of girls thinking that they're bad at math and that they will have worse scores.
Yeah, it's also interesting because that kind of ties into a different concept called stereotype threat, which is like if you are aware of a certain negative stereotype about yourself, like being bad at math, studies have shown that like people who are made aware versus not aware of being bad at math, for like men and women, women always perform a lot worse on math tests when they're told it's a measure of gender difference in math versus just, oh, this is a math test, like fill it out. And then men and women normally have the same scores. So yeah, there's a lot of things at play with academic performance and just, you know, being aware of yourself too much. And an example of the self-fulfilling prophecy that I have is that I feel like people, I didn't realize this until like after high school, but people thought I was really shy in high school, and maybe I was, I don't really know, but I went traveling for like a year after high school, and then I came back and, you know, I thought I was just like being myself, and I was like talking to somebody I knew from high school, and he was like, whoa, like you've changed so much, like you're so outgoing now. And I was like, I don't think I had actually changed that much. It's more just maybe there was like that time where I was gone, and maybe he thought like, oh, traveling like changed her, but he had never really like tried to talk to me that much, or like, you know what I mean? I feel like he was treating me in a certain way that was in line with what he thought I was like, and then he actually ended up talking to me for once, and I was like, whoa, what the heck, like I didn't know this. So maybe that is an example. That's what I hypothesize, at least, is that it could be an example. And yeah.
that's the end of those.
That's the end of those.
I added a little bit of notes for this for nurture. This is something that is separate from the more typical or more known or more research-based examples, but it could also be these self schemas could be you know, human made. You could make them yourself by this the phenomenon of manifestation, which some of you may have heard of, which is kind of that thing where you use self affirmations, which say, you know, you listen to audio or you talk to yourself and you say, oh, you know, everyone loves me, or I'm a great this, or I'm beautiful, or things like that. And I guess some of us have heard that, you know, talking to yourself in the mirror and saying you are great kind of thing. And that is a type of self-affirmation, which is part of manifestation. There is not, it is very back and forth in research about this, and it is criticized in academia a lot, because there are benefits to it, to being positive and thinking these thoughts, because it can lead into these positive self schemas, which can lead into your behaviors. But if you make these goals too lofty, it doesn't really have the effects that, and it won't work in the way that you think. So for example, you could just say to yourself in the mirror, like, oh, I am kind. You know, what's that going to do? You don't really understand what's going on there, kind of thing. You can't just look and say, I am kind. But if you say something that's more specific, like every day I try to say something kind and do what I can to help others, that is more of an action you can do. And if you say to yourself that, that does have more tangible results to lead into a more positive self schema. But this is not exactly research based. This is just something that's more, not pop culture, but has more cultural meaning and as well history to it, because this has been done for a long, long time in history.
Yeah, like more spiritual, I think, too.
Yeah, and more definitely.
Things that's more spiritual, because people, yeah, like the power of your brain is super strong, so it would make sense why you could think that you can control who you are, kind of.
I've got like all these little notes on my mirror now. It's like, it's like, oh, love isn't conditional. So, you know, I feel like they have to be, if you do want to do something with self-affirmations, they have to be personal to you. And I think that you should make them yourself, and they should be tangible goals. And they can lead into you breaking from your more negative thoughts and contributing to, you know, you're already having confirmation bias and you're already self-fulfilling prophecies, for example. And then one more point I wanted to mention for this, for nurture, was just life stressors in general, which is pretty general, but just stress.
Yeah.
I think that it can work both ways, because these stressors can increase the amount of negative schemas you have. For example, you know, if you're working a really hard, if you're working a job and you're working 10 hours a day and you come home and you have no energy to cook and you're like, oh, I'm such a bad mom kind of thing. You know, it's like, well, you've been working so long and you don't have any energy to spend. And so, you know, all this stress can lead you into not, you know, lead into these negative thoughts. And it can also work in the positive end as well, because, you know, if you are able to build resilience from your life stressors as well, like, for example, someone in your family dies and it's terrible, but over the years you get over it and you're like, oh, I got over that, you know, I'm a strong person, kind of thing. And so it can go both ways, but I thought that could be mentionable.
And for the nature side of things, I was also wondering, like, are self-schemas part of our nature? Like, just are we born with certain inclinations to believe negative or positively about ourselves? And there is such a thing as temperament, which I also learned about recently, is that temperament is individual differences in emotional reactivity. It's based in biology, so it is kind of a concept about like being inherently something. Like we say, oh, no one's born with a certain personality, but temperament is kind of the closest thing to that. And it's consistent across situations and time pretty much since birth. And there's a lot of different scales people use for temperament, but I'm going to go through just like a few from Mary Rothbart. So it could be like irritability, activity level, like how involved you are in certain things and how much like passion you have for certain things, positive affectivity, that's just like positive affect, positive feeling, fearful distress. So like those things can kind of feed into how you start responding to situations and then how you start seeing yourself based on that.
Yeah, I feel like temperament is a big thing as well for schemas. Kind of related, not related, but I just met someone. I met a guy through a friend, and this guy was the most interesting person I've ever met in my entire life. He was like one of those people who, he speaks really slow, first of all. He speaks really slow. He's a really nice guy, but he's like, oh, are we going to the shopping mall? Like, it's like he is a nice guy, and I've been talking about this with someone, and it is so interesting. Like, how does someone, is that temperament just normally, and that's how they act throughout life? And he's just this guy, he just never gets irritated, he never gets annoyed, he's always cool-minded, he speaks slow, eats slow, walks slow, everything slow. It's like, what?
It's like a sloth.
How is that possible? I'm like, there's something, you know, there's definitely something biological about this. And it's just interesting because there's no way we're all the same. We have all the same, you know, levels of being irritated. Like, we all have different scales of everything, which, I mean, we already know, but.
Yeah.
That was a little side story.
Side note, this super slow guy.
Fun sides. Fun side note. I mean, I feel like it's refreshing to see someone move so slow in a world that we move so fast.
True.
We all have ADHD.
He's taking his time.
I mean, we don't all have ADHD. That's, I didn't say that, but
you do.
That we all think that we all have ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, also going into my example for this nature, speaking of ADHD, I think neurodivergence can lead to more negative self schemas, going more negative side, because those who are diagnosed or have neurodivergence, nothing against the community as I'm in it myself, but that it can lead to having more negative thoughts about yourself. It's like, oh, you know, why can't I fit in? Like, why can't I socially be fitting in with these people? Like, why is this taking me so hard? Like, why is this taking me so much time to learn this kind of thing?
Mm.
And it just feeds into that cycle of like, oh, I must be stupid. I must be dumb. I must be socially awkward. And that is just something that is really difficult, I think, especially for that community.
Yeah. There's also something to say for cultural context, because I think we've been mostly talking about this discussion through the lens of a more individualistic culture, which emphasizes autonomy and internal traits and stuff like that. But there's also interdependent cultures where self-schemas overlap with other people's self-schemas in with like their social roles and relationships. So that can also be different.
Yeah.
Anyway,
we are actually we've been talking about this for a while, but we gotta wrap it up.
We're running out of time. So we're just gonna talk about how we can change, maybe, and then end it off there.
Yeah, and the benefits. Yeah. You know, we don't need the benefits.
We're skipping over the negative and positive impacts.
You guys know.
You can think of them yourselves.
So, how to change self schemas? Go to therapy.
Go to therapy.
Number one.
Questioning what comes automatically, because I think a lot of times we just like don't question it, we just take it as fact, but any assumptions, interpretations, expectations of any situation you're in, just question it and be like, why do I feel like this? What evidence is there for this? What counter evidence is there? Mm-hmm. Like that kind of thing.
And to do this, I feel like, you know, we can just say like, oh, you can question it, but sometimes you don't even know what you're questioning because the thought comes up and you're like, You aren't even aware that you're having that thought. So I think that a way to actually question is to, first of all, be more vulnerable in conversation in general. Because you can actually learn what is automatic to what you're thinking, like these assumptions and expectations, when you tell other people what's on your mind, for example. Because if you open up about feeling stupid and your friend's like, what? You know, like, I don't think you're stupid. You do this. They can give you an external perspective and you can start questioning what is automatic, which is, I think, like a cheat code to do that.
True.
And as well, you know, and as well, just being a good listener, and you can notice the self-schemas in others and how it looks in perspective to them. So the opposite, like a friend saying she's stupid, you know, then you can think, well, no, you do this. And then you can be like, oh, well, you know, if she's thinking like that, what are things that I think of? So I think just opening up more in conversation as well to get into these conversations about what you're struggling with is a big thing that we need to also do.
Mm-hmm. Little tips and tricks for you guys.
Tips
but that's it for today. Next up is our friend Lynn's open mic, so stay tuned for that. And then after that, Bitcoover at 8 p.m. Thank you all so much for listening.
I think we've got one more song,
two more songs left in us. So this next song is called Dirt and Onions, and it is by Frank. So have a lovely rest of your night, and we'll see you next week. Bye! Become a little thing.
mother's garden is almost empty. There's only dirt and onions left. They last forever. Cut the tops off, keep the roots, begin again. I wanted flowers, they asked for flowers, so they would come from me. All our webs they weave together. Forget how it's meant to be.